Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the Jazz on the Tube podcast. This is where we talk about the music in depth, and we talk to all kinds of interesting people, authors, scholars, filmmakers, people doing interesting productions, musicians who are also educators, and today is really a red-letter day for Jazz on the Tube. I think if someone were to ask me what's the most important thing that we could achieve in jazz in the next couple of years, it would be to put this particular musician who we're going to be speaking about in a few minutes higher up on the map. She is of incredible importance, not only as a performer, a soloist, a composer, an arranger, but also as an educator of some of the greats and a colleague of some of the great musicians that you know broke down doors and blazed new trails in music. And a lot of people know her and recognize her name, but there's an awful lot of jazz musicians and jazz fans that do not. And that is a grave mistake. And so I was really glad to hear that somebody went out and made a film about this musician who we're going to be talking about. And so we're going to be talking about the film, this wonderful musician who I had the great good fortune to hear. Unfortunately, I was only in high school, and I wasn't very well educated, and I didn't really understand the full import of what I was experiencing, but I did get to hear her play once, and I think I'm going to spend the rest of my life making up for the fact that I didn't understand what I was seeing when I was 16. So, everybody, welcome. Help me welcome Carol Bash. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me.
And the topic of Carol's film, the one we're going to be talking about on this call, is the great, and I don't say this lightly, the great Mary Lou Williams. And if it's not somebody who you recognize, this is going to be a really interesting and enlightening call. If it is somebody you recognize, do let your friends know about this particular podcast, because really every jazz fan should know who Mary Lou Williams was and what she did. And hey, Carol, I'm just going to ask, I'm hearing some like clicks.
Oh, okay. You know what? I was probably fanning myself. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I know. We're doing this on the first. We're doing this on the very first hot day of the year, and we went from like 40 below to 90 degrees in 2 days, and so the heat feels all the more extreme. But it makes the call more authentic.
Right.
But it does make a lot of noise, so.
Okay. I stopped. I'm willing to sweat for Mary Lou Williams.
There you go. And I am, too. I turned the air conditioner off. No external noise. All right. So let's tell people the name of the film, the name of the website, and then let's get into the life of this truly remarkable human being. Mm-hmm. And so what's the name of the film?
So the name of the film is Mary Lou Williams, The Lady Who Swings the Band. And it's 68-minute PBS. It aired on PBS in 2015, but it is available for sale on the educational market. If anybody's interested in more information about the film and a little bit about Mary Lou Williams, you can always log on to my website, which is MaryLouWilliamsProject.com. MaryLouWilliamsProject.com.
Great.
So.
Mm-hmm. Great. So for people that don't know, you're one of the ideal people to introduce who Mary Lou Williams was and why she is so important to the music that we all love.
Well, you know, and quite honestly, Ken, I didn't really know who Mary Lou Williams was either when I, you know, first was introduced to her. It was like, well, at this point, probably close to 15 years. It took me 11 years to make the film. So there's a journey there. But I didn't really know who she was. And luckily, my father-in-law, who unfortunately has since passed, was a Mary Lou Williams fan. So he knew. And basically, how I tell the story is that I'd say, yeah, good, like 15 years ago at this point, I went into my in-law's house and he was playing her on the stereo. And I was just bowled over by just what I was hearing. You know, it was one of her later pieces.
Mm-hmm.
It was a piece that she had composed in the 1970s called Syllogism. It's on her Zoning CD. And it was just so funky. And I asked my father-in-law, I said, who is this? And he was just like, that's Mary Lou Williams. She's one of the greats. And I do know jazz, and I love jazz, and I had never heard of this woman. And I was like, really? So I just sort of filed that away, like, okay, wow, that's interesting. I didn't know who this woman was. But a year later, a book came out about her life. And the book is really a wonderful read, too. It's called Morning Glory, The Biography of Mary Lou Williams by Linda Dahl. And read that book, and I was like, I have to do a documentary on this woman. I mean, it's just a crime that nobody, you know, that we just don't know who she is. So that was the beginning of a very long but fruitful and, you know, inspiring journey.
Great. So just like a lot of us, you discovered her gradually, and then suddenly it dawned on you, how is it possible this person who contributed so much is not on the top of everybody's short list of great jazz people?
Exactly. You know, I mean, I to sum it all up, she's one of the inventors of jazz. You know, I mean, that's how I look at her. You know, she was, her career spans, you know, from 19 teens at the emergence of jazz and goes up into her death, which was in 1981. And she died basically on her deathbed. She was still composing.
Yep.
So, you know, her whole journey is one of being at the forefront of this art form and one of the creators, you know, along with the other greats that we do know, in moving the art form forward. She was a perpetual, you know, innovator. And so, you know, her life and her music really span, you know, all those changes within jazz, you know, whether it's very early on boogie woogie to swing to bebop to, you know, more experimental funk driven pieces in the 60s and 70s. And then she even, you know, made a contribution to religious music. So, yikes.
Exactly. Exactly. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but there's a great quote from Duke Ellington himself about Mary Lou Williams. I'm looking for it on the website. I've seen it 100 times. Now, of course, I can't find it. But even if we can't quote it exactly, if anybody's wondering, gee, is this, you know, are Ken and Carol just, you know, super fans of this obscure musician? No, Duke Ellington was a huge fan of Mary Lou Williams and her contributions. So I want to, maybe I'll start with one thing that just might blow people's minds. Mary Lou Williams had an apartment, and somewhere the address should be a
63 Hamilton Terrace.
There you go.
63 Hamilton Terrace.
Yep.
I'll say it. It's 63 Hamilton Terrace in New York, New York. So it was in Harlem.
Gotcha. And the things that happened musically in her apartment were so important that there's a group of musicians out in the Bay Area that have called their group Mary Lou's apartment, or Mary Lou Williams' apartment. Let's talk a little bit about the role that she played in the bebop era. Mm. Now, as you pointed out, she played important, influential roles throughout the whole span of jazz history. But I think the one that really might surprise people is her key role in bebop.
Right. I mean, you know, when we think of bebop, of course, we think of Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell. You know, I mean, those are, you know, the icons, Miles Davis, those are the icons of, you know, bebop. And I think what might surprise people that have never heard of Mary Lou Williams is that all of these musicians that I just named certainly knew Mary Lou Williams, and not only knew her, but they looked up to her as someone who was a mentor to them. And so basically, you know, they were all in New York City during the late 40s, early 50s at the, well, they're the inventors of bebop. So they were there. And they would go to Mary Lou's apartment at 63 Hamilton Terrace after their gigs, or sometimes they would even pick her up and drive, you know, after her gig. And they would just sort of sit at her feet, you know, and because she was such an innovative composer and arranger, they would bring their tunes, you know, to her and for her to listen to, for her to give feedback on. You know, it was sort of like a workshop, if you will, where all these great musicians would come to hear and to learn, you know, chordings and phrasings from Mary Lou. And so, yes, she had a very close relationship with Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk in particular. And, you know, basically it was through her that influenced and shaped their sounds. So that is her. That, I mean, she also composed bebop tunes, but I would say her influence was really very much a part of, you know, teaching and mentoring the greats that we know of as the bebop giants today. Yeah.
Great. And she was a little bit older than them, so she was a bit more well-established.
Right. She was, you know, I would say, yeah, she was probably like 10 years older, you know, mm-hmm. So, you know, because she had come up, you know, her, I guess you could say, if you know a little bit about her career, you know, she came to prominence as a swing composer and arranger with the Andy Kirk Band in the 1930s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And she was the composer and arranger, which was very unusual for a woman to be in that position for a predominantly all male band. She was the only female in that band. So she had that experience and also just the fact that her arrangements with that band, the swing arrangements, were very forward thinking and innovative. And certainly, you know, so when she was in Kansas City, you know, those musicians, they knew of her. You know, she was well known. She was famous. And so when she moved to New York, it was just something that they would naturally be attracted to her and her innovations and how she heard music, that they would just take advantage of the fact that they were all in the same city together and come and hang out.
And by virtue of the fact that she was a composer and an arranger and had been for already a good chunk of time, to do that and to do that successfully in the hyper-competitive world of jazz, she really knew music theory and what you could actually do with music. And that is something that may not be as obvious to fans, but all jazz musicians have to become experts on music theory, whether it's by the book or by practical experience. Mm-hmm. But one way or another, they have to become, if they're going to advance as artists, they have to become very knowledgeable. A classical musician, if they can handle their instrument and read a score, they've got a job, you know, which is great. Mm. But if a jazz musician is going to have a career and sustain that career over decades, which is the goal, of course, they have to innovate by definition. And not only do they have to innovate every night, you know, which is really, if you think about it, I don't know any other profession. You know, if you're a doctor, you pretty much do the same thing every day. Maybe something unusual comes up and you have to do some thinking. But general, it's pretty routine. But in the profession of jazz, you have to be an innovator. And to be an innovator, you've really got to have a solid grasp of music theory. So my guess is one of the things that these then young revolutionary musicians were coming to Mary Lou for was to get some insight into this matrix of theory that everybody has got to master if they're going to become, you know, sustaining jazz musicians.
Exactly. And, you know, I just also want to just also say something else about that. I mean, the fact that, you know, bebop at the time was very revolutionary, right? I mean, it really changed. I mean, I'm not a musicologist, so I can't speak on those terms, but it dramatically altered the rhythm and pacing of jazz. And not all jazz musicians prior to the bebop movement could make that transition. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of the swing musicians were saying, this is just too hard, or it's too out there and crazy that I'm just not going to play anymore. I can't get with what these young cats are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not every jazz musician that really made the transition to bebop. And so I know another thing about Mary Lou Williams is that she got it. You know, she understood the chordings and the phrasings because she was also very much an avant-gardist and very much experimental with what she was doing prior to the bebop movement. So, you know, the fact that she kind of crossed the lexicon, you know, mm-hmm. speaks again to her innovation and her forward thinkingness, you know, as far as being a musician and someone who's always out there on the cutting edge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every time there's one of these major shifts in the music, yeah, not everybody goes with it. and especially hard, you know, to be fair, it's hard if you're established, you're in your 30s or your 40s and you've sort of built a career on a certain track. And now everybody's sort of upturning the apple cart and saying, no, we're going to do it this way now. That requires a lot of mental flexibility, which she clearly had. But not only did she have it, but she contributed to it by working with these then young musicians. There's a series of photographs, I'm sure you've seen them, that show her literally in her living room with Dizzy Gillespie, Jack Teagarden, which is interesting. He's a swing guy, but he made the transition too. He was open-minded, and a whole bunch of other well-known musicians. And there's her piano, and there she is, and there's everybody hanging out. It's a beautiful thing. It's a series of photographs. Can you talk a little bit about her background? You know, where was she born, and what you know about her early musical training, and how she found herself as a very rare swing composer and arranger in the 30s?
Right. So she was born on May 8th, 1910. So her birthday is coming up soon. And she was born in Atlanta, Georgia. And how her mother puts it is that at the age of 3, her mother played the piano for the local church. Her mother was a little bit of a musician as well. And Mary Lou was sitting on her lap. And then all of a sudden, Mary Lou played a tune or a series of notes that was so surprising to her mother that her mother actually dropped her and ran out and got the neighbors. And like, you listen to what my, you know, 3-year-old toddler just did, you know?
Wow.
So basically, Mary Lou was a prodigy. You know, she was one of those people that was just innately born with a gift for music. And, you know, she looks at it, and I should say that the film, my documentary on Mary Lou, is told through her words, because Mary Lou also wrote several manuscripts with the idea of trying to write or publish a book about her life. It never came to fruition, but there's plenty of what, you know, she wrote about her life that's there. And so I, as much as we could, we used her words to tell her journey. And so how she puts it is that she would always hear music, you know, just an ordinary daily sound. She just had an affinity to music. When she was, I would say six, maybe 5 or 6, her family moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it was there that, you know, she was raised, and even though she was born in Atlanta, she always thinks of Pittsburgh as really being her hometown, because that's actually her family still, there's still members of her family that, that continue to live in Pittsburgh. And she was, you know, again, she would go out and play with local musicians. She talks about playing with the wealthy Pittsburgh families like the Mellons and the Carnegies. She had a reputation even as a little girl. They called her the little piano girl of East Liberty. And so even at a very young age, she was out with local musicians playing, you know, for tea gardens and whatever, or playing for church organizations. And at that point she was playing stride and boogie woogie, or actually more stride. So she wasn't composing or anything like that. But she would talk about how even at that early age, and she didn't read music at that point, but she would even in the presence of musicians that could read, she would pick up very quickly what the song was. You know, she had that kind of autodidactic kind of gift. She left home very early. Like, she was 14 years old. There was a little trouble at home. Her parents drank, you know, so it was a very chaotic household. And she left at the age of 14 to join a traveling group on the TOBA circuit, which is sort of like one of those like theater circuits. It's vaudeville. We're talking about now, we're in the time of vaudeville. And so, you know, the acts then were very sort of showcasey, you know, very sort of minstrel humor. Mm-hmm. And the musicians, what they would do is they would do tricks. You know, they would like sort of play, you know, instruments with their toes or their turn. You know, Mary Lou said she would turn around on the piano stool and play with her elbows, that kind of thing. And then one day she was playing, doing her shtick, if you will, and a musician came up and said, "Hey, little girl, I heard some really good chords in what you were playing. You should forget about the clowning and really play seriously." Mm. And that stuck with her. And she said from that point on, she decided to be a serious musician. So that's the early career. And at that point, she met her then husband, John Williams, who also became a part of this traveling minstrel show. They broke away from the show, formed their own band, and eventually, you know, traveled around with his band, John Williams Syncopators. And they were doing sort of blues and boogie woogie. And then John Williams became a member of the Andy Kirk Band in Kansas City. And then at that point, Mary Lou followed him, but did not become a member of the band because they already had a piano player. But she followed him to Kansas City, and she really cites Kansas City in the 1930s as being like her learning ground, her stomping ground, because, you know, Kansas City was just a nexus for all kinds of music, you know, not just jazz, but blues and, you know, just everything. And so, and all the great musicians would stop by there and play. And so she really sort of looked at that place as just where she picked up, you know, the meat of being a jazz musician. She would go out on gigs and, you know, and just do all night jam sessions, you know, all that kind of great, you know, learning for a young jazz artist. So that's the beginning of her, I would say, the real education of her becoming a jazz great.
And she managed to survive, because that was, you know, that was a tough environment. You know, we can't really easily imagine what it was like playing in those in those Kansas City clubs after hours in the 30s. I mean, that was a rough place.
It was rough. I mean, she talks about, you know, she talks about gangsters, you know, running the joints, you know,
yeah,
and, you know, and basically saying, not paying the musicians, and saying, look, you're going to play until I tell you to stop kind of thing. And we're talking, you know, we're talking about hardcore, you know, Bugsy Malone, you know, Al Capone, you know, type gangsters. They would kill you. So, you know, so it was that. And then also the musicians themselves, you know, were tough. I mean, it wasn't a lifestyle for a quote unquote lady. You know, you really had to be tough. You were a tough broad. And she talks about, you know, sitting at the piano and, you know, some musician would come and just knock her off the stool or shove her, you know, push her around with his elbows because she wasn't playing the way that, you know, the musicians needed her to play. I mean, so it was like she learned through hard knocks, if you will. Like you either had to sink or swim in that environment. And it didn't matter if you were a woman, you either did it or you didn't do it.
You're right. Right.
You know.
And it wasn't like going to the new school and getting a BA in jazz performance.
No, it was truly pass fail. You know, right. There was nothing genteel about, you know, or higher ed. I mean, it was definitely you were learning through the school of hard knocks. You know,
so we really got to just, you know, above and beyond her contribution as a performer and composer and arranger and mentor, she really had a lot of grit to survive in that milieu and thrive and get through it and then be such a gracious human being that she was.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely.
So she made it through the maelstrom of St. Louis, of Kansas City, and picked up a lot of great musical experiences. Then what happened? Then what did she do?
Well, so then basically, you know, as I said, in the meantime, you know, Mary Lou's going around, you know, Vine Street and doing her after hour jam sessions. But her husband was part of the Andy Kirk band, and this was also a time of, you know, big bands coming to light, you know, the Jimmy Lunsford band and the Count Basie band and, you know, the Duke Ellington band had already been established, but this was the beginning of the big band era. And so the Andy Kirk band was one of those bands that was based out of Kansas City that would play sort of dance music. It's not swing, but dance music. Andy Kirk wanted to be a dance band, you know, sort of like a ballroom. He kind of, how Mary Lou puts it is that he wanted to be the Black Guy Lombardo, you know?
Okay.
So basically, John Williams, Mary Lou's husband, John Williams was the saxophone player in the band. But John was also he realized and recognized Mary Lou's immense talent and was always sort of pushing Andy like, hey, why don't you get Mary Lou to play, you know? And, you know, and there's, you know, there's basically, you know, the gender politics of the day. And he's like, I don't want any woman playing for my band. This is a man's band, right? Because men and women did not belong in the same bands. But basically what happened one day is that a producer came to hear the band, and the producer was a producer of, I think, Decca Records, and it was for a recording contract. And the piano player that the band had, didn't show up. He was, I guess, a drinker or whatever. He just didn't show up. And, you know, John was like to Andy Kirk, you know, let's get Mary Lou, you know, let's get her in. And Mary Lou, meanwhile, was always like travel with the band, and she knew the song, she knew the music, and of course she was just a great musical talent that she would just pick things up. So, you know, it was like one of those cases where Andy, it was an emergency, they needed someone, and Andy's like, okay, go get Mary Lou, you know, I don't know where this guy is. And so she filled in, and the producer loves the band, and he says, okay, I'm going to record, I want you guys to, you know, come to Chicago, and we'll, you know, record you. And so basically what happens is that the band then goes to Chicago, but they don't take Mary Lou. You know, they take the regular guy that didn't show up because this is the thinking of the day. And he was like, thanks, Mary. See ya. And then so to, you know, the producer's, you know, credit, you know, the band gets there and he's like, where's the girl? You know, where's Mary Lou? And Andy Kirk's like, well, you know, we don't need her. We brought our guy. And he's like, no, you get Mary Lou. She's
great.
One of the reasons why I wanted to record you. So you get her. And so, you know, they send for Mary Lou, who's in Kansas City. And she gets to the studio, and then they record her. And there's a whole other tragic thing that happens to Mary Lou on the way up to the recording studio. It's in the film, but if you don't have a chance to see the film, I'll tell you that, you know, she was raped on the train from Kansas City to Chicago. The amazing thing, you know, I mean, as traumatic as that, I couldn't even imagine that was, is that she somehow within herself and within her strength and in her need to be, you know, a musician, you know, she basically compartmentalized that and did not bring that up. I don't think she talked about that until years later. So they didn't know, and she didn't mention it. She goes into the studio and, like, there's this outpouring of just incredible blues and this really sort of unique song named Nightlife. And basically what happened is that the band was warming up, or they weren't quite ready to record, and the sound engineer says, you know, Mary Lou, while the band's warming up, just play something. And she, you know, this is her coming off of the train after this horrendous experience. And she just pours her heart out into this song called Nightlife. And it's actually upbeat and very complicated. And it's one of her early great songs. But anyway, the recording session goes on. You know, the band does great. And then, you know, I would say like maybe a year or two later, she actually does become a member of the Andy Kirk band. And what she does as a member of the band, however, is that she starts to hear how the band sound should change. You know, she is interested not in having the band be a dance band, but she loves swing. And she thinks that the tunes that the band plays should really swing more and be harder hitting. And so she starts to, I guess, basically to write songs for the band. And it's those songs that become the signature sound and hits for the Andy Kirk band.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So the songs that, you know, if you, you know, basically get some Andy Kirk CDs, and let me just say that all the music that I'm referring to, you know, whether it's Mary Lou's music or Andy Kirk's music, it's all available. You can get it on iTunes or, you know, Amazon, you know, it's all there. And the song that the Andy Kirk band, you know, basically plays and have been recorded that as the great hits are songs that were written by Mary Lou Williams. So gotcha.
And so, you know, talent won out, you know, and once she got a chance, it was clear that this was someone you had to listen to, and she transformed this band. And of course that's again, a very rare thing. I don't think can we even name another woman in that era who had the opportunity to compose and arrange for, you know, a top tier band.
You know, I honestly can't. And let me just also add that it wasn't even just Andy Kirk's band, because, you know, another interesting piece, of course, of gender politics is that Andy Kirk didn't pay her what he should have been paying her.
Yeah.
And so she started to write for other bands. And so, you know, her sound is not only just with the Andy Kirk band, but She was saying everybody asked me for arrangements. So we're talking about the Count Basie Band and the Benny Goodman Band and, you know, just name of any, she says all the great bands, Louis Armstrong, all these bands, band leaders wanted her to write and arrange for them. And she did. So she was not only just the engineer of the Andy Kirk Band, but of the swing bands in general, white and black. That's her contribution to that music. It really spans, you know, all the great bands of that time, which is really remarkable. And no, I can't think of any woman and man, yeah, quite honestly, you know, that really has that kind of signature on that era.
Now, I don't know the answer to this question. Maybe you learned about it in the course of your research. It may not even exist, but I wonder if anybody's ever thought to put together a compilation of performances that were based on or played from Mary Lou Williams' compositions and arrangements. That would be a really interesting thing to have, be able to put your hands on.
That would be really incredible. I could say not that I'm aware of. I think maybe there might have been, like, I think the Dutch Jazz Orchestra did some recording of her arrangements that had never been recorded before. Jerry Allen did some recordings of her Zodiac Suite. But are you talking about, like, basically a compilation of the whole breadth of her career from, like, swing to... Because, I mean, there's been some pieces, yes.
It would be really interesting if somebody went and, you know, let's say they found an arrangement that she did for Benny Goodman, put that on track one, and then found an arrangement she did for Duke Ellington or Count Basie or, you know, any one of the many, many orchestras she wrote for, and put these on a single album so that people could just, you know, hear her arrangements in different contexts. I'm not the world's greatest discophile in the world, but I'm not aware of it. And I think I would have seen it if it existed.
Right. No, I don't think something like that exists. I mean, I pretty much have, you know, gone through her whole repertoire in doing this film. And no, there hasn't been a real compilation of all the music that she's arranged and composed and put onto. It'd be a multi CD set. What a great idea, though. You know, what a great idea.
Well, you know, in the world of YouTube or maybe even Spotify, I'm not a Spotify user yet. I'm still holding out, but I'll probably succumb at some point. But maybe somebody who's got these kind of, I'm going to say discophile, there's probably a better word, jazzophile. You know, there are people that are really, really great scholars of the music. And I bet somebody listening to this or somebody listening to this can either do it themselves or they know the exact person in their life who could do this. And we all have a friend like that in jazz, two or three. And this could be done on YouTube or it could be done on Spotify. And people could just sit back and listen and see, you know, get some sense of the scope of her big band work. You know, and you know, those were the days when big bands were the popular music in America. So, she got tremendous clout musically. Even if people didn't realize that they were listening to a Mary Lou Williams arrangement, they heard the music and it went in and influenced them. So when the later 40s rolled around and Bud Powell and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk were working on the bebop revolution, Mary Lou Williams had been around, to say the least, and was pretty, you know, pretty well established and had really well developed musical sophistication. Because, you know, to write for a big band, you really have to know music well. You have to know how all the tones go together and how all the timbres of the different instruments sound together. It's a tremendous amount of knowledge you have to have. So I can see why those young musicians would have just loved to get her feedback on things. So she maintained this sort of, gosh, for lack of a better word, there's a salon, the great French word, a salon in her apartment for young, innovative musicians. What was her career like, let's say, starting in the 50s and toward, and to the end of her life. She lived, this is a very interesting life.
Right. I would say in the late 40s, early 50s, you know, her career started to shift a little bit. And that's because, you know, music itself shifted, right? Where music then became, you know, jazz music became a listening music. You weren't getting up and dancing to it. You were going to nightclubs, right? The venues became smaller. You know, the bands were sort of not around anymore. There are more combos and, you know, two or three musicians. It's sort of like what we're used to hearing today. You know, that started in the late 40s. I mean, of course, some big bands stuck around. Duke Ellington, you know, was timeless, and Count Basie. But more or less, you know, musicians, jazz musicians would make their living in smaller venues. And so that's what Mary Lou transitioned out of the big bands to her being a headliner. You know, and what's interesting about that is that she was the headliner, you know, in the 40s and the early 50s. She was the band leader, or she would do solo. She would be, you know, a solo performer. I would say, you know, the difficulty that she was finding in her career was that because she was always changing the sound of her music, because she's an innovator and an artist, mm-hmm. that she became hard to categorize and therefore hard to market, right? Mm-hmm. So now, while, you know, these, you know, musicians like Dizzy and Miles and, you know, are getting these very lucrative recording contracts, you know, with Blue Note and those kinds of, you know, record companies, they didn't know how to place Mary Lou. You know, she was swing, you know, now she's doing a little bebop, and she didn't really get the kind of, you know, play the way she was getting with the Andy Kirk Band as far as studio work was concerned. She was still, you know, very well known. You know, she would travel around with, you know, doing nightclub gigs and nightclub work. But she really, really tried to find a major recording company, and they wouldn't take her on, believe it or not. And so she was always kind of relegated in that time period to smaller independent labels. And so I think at that point, we're starting to see a little bit of her popularity kind of fade. And plus, she's been around, and she's like, an older generation, even though she's not old, she's in her 40s, you know, she's looked upon as being an older generation. And, you know, it's the young kids coming up now with, you know, the new sound. So what she does is that she also was starting to be very much more interested in symphonic music, you know, merging, if you will. I mean, you know, think this is happening in, you know, in her head in the late 40s, merging classical music and jazz music together. So she has the opportunity to compose a suite, which she called the Zodiac Suite, and play it at Carnegie Hall, which she did with the Carnegie Pops Symphony Orchestra. And that happened, I believe in 1946, and she's the first African-American female jazz composer to have this opportunity. Mm. And, you know, today it's sort of like, oh, you know, we hear that all the time kind of thing. You know, it's what I forgot the name of this genre, what they call it. It's not new wave. Was it new? Next wave?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, never mind. Sorry. But, you know, merging jazz and classical back then was just not heard of and definitely looked down upon by the classical world. And so, even though she had that opportunity, it didn't go any further. So with her sort of not having the kind of popularity that the other musicians were finding at that time, and not being able to sort of move forward on the symphonic level, she decides that she's going to take a break from the United States and go to Europe to see if she can sort of resurrect a career abroad. Because basically she felt that there was no place for her in the United States anymore for the kind of music that she wanted to play. So she left and went to Europe in the early 50s to try to do something at that point.
Which is something actually a fair number of jazz musicians were doing as well. You know, trying Europe as a more, and even today, musicians are going to Europe and some don't come home. I just think of the great Joseph Bowie, trombone player, and he went to Holland. He hasn't been back. And I looked him up. He's doing great. And, you know, maybe he's come back to perform, but there's a lot of cats like that. And so, and, you know, we run something here called Jazz on the Tube. And one of the things we do is every day we send out an email to our subscribers about a clip of jazz film that we found. And it's amazing what a high percentage of the good stuff we have only because of Europe, whether
right.
it's, you know, the BBC or Danish TV or Swedish TV or French TV or German TV mm-hmm. or Dutch TV. I mean, they were willing to spend more money and showcase the music in ways that just were not happening in the United States. So we've got we really have to thank Europe for preserving this American art. So do you know what countries that she went to when she was in Europe? Did she stay in a particular one? Or
she stayed primarily in London and Paris, you know, and then she would travel. She started in London. She didn't, and then eventually didn't, you know, like London, fell out of favor with London or England, and then moved to Paris, and then would travel. You know, she went to Germany, she went to Belgium, she went to Italy. She did a pretty wide loop wherever, you know, the music took her.
Mm-hmm.
I would say her experience, though, in Europe wasn't quite what she expected it to be. I mean, she was thinking that would be, you know, a venue for experimentation. And, you know, at this point, she really was trying to sort of ride along the lines of being experimental like bebop, you know, listening to those kinds of atonal and different kinds of melodies and harmonies. But when she, and there were plenty of musicians there. I mean, you know, that's the thing that she would say, that, you know, everybody was there and they would party and it was a great time for her to sort of be connected with some old friends. But in general, she didn't find that the Europeans wanted to hear that kind of music, or at least they didn't want to hear it from her. You know,
mm-hmm.
she kind of feels like they wanted to hear more of her older kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, being a perpetual innovator, wasn't interested in playing that. And therefore started to really become depressed and wanted to not, just really, I would say at this point, she became depressed and
okay.
didn't know where her, you know, what would be next for her career. And some people say that she more or less had a breakdown in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And then came back to New York in the mid-50s, like around 1954, and wanted to take a break. She said she wanted to take a break from music, from jazz. She left it. She left it behind.
Well, it kind of goes back to something we were talking about earlier, which is that, you know, this is a profession that requires constant innovation, constant to the point of every night you have to be creating something. And just suddenly be told, well, you know, we're really not interested in that. Just keep playing those old tunes you played 40 years ago, when her engine, her innovation engine, was probably still in high gear. That must have been very, very frustrating.
extremely frustrating. Exactly. And it's sort of like, you know, and what does that do to your soul, you know, as an artist, where you're giving your all, you're putting everything of yourself into innovating and moving things forward and listening and sharing your gifts, you know, with an audience that's not really interested in what you're doing, you know, or where you are and or meeting you, you know. So to constantly be kind of maybe butting up against that kind of thinking, I would say it probably does damage your soul after a point where you probably feel like you're going crazy. Like, why am I doing this? And nobody cares and nobody likes what I'm doing. Why? What's the point, kind of thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really where she got to. And plus, at that point, you know, she'd been traveling and working her entire life, you know, from the age of 7 or 8, you know, and not taking vacations. She wasn't making a lot of money, even though she was successful. It was always a struggle. And so it's not like she, you know, she would be able to take breaks and holidays, and she wasn't living the high life. She was always working. She was always hustling. So that combined with just, you know, not being appreciated for her innovation, I think she just, it just became too much for her to bear, and she just had to walk away for a minute.
You know, as we alluded to earlier too, it's, and you've just said it as well. I mean, it's at the best of times, it's a tough, it's a physically demanding profession. You know, it's a physical job. People don't think of music that way, but it's physical. And if, you know, for instance, if your back hurts or you got tendonitis in the hand, I mean, you'd be surprised how many great musicians, you don't know the kind of just physical challenges they're dealing with to get on stage every night. So, you roll a few decades up like that, and then the frustration of not having your work accepted. I mean, it's a lot. So she took a break.
Right. So then, you know, basically she came back to New York, to Harlem, to her apartment. And I would say at that point, she needed solace and peace of mind is how I would put it. She started to feel that she needed maybe some spiritual salvation, something to give her soul some peace, and started to gravitate towards the Catholic Church. She tried different religions. This isn't in the film, but we do focus on the film, like how she found the Catholic Church to be peaceful and calm. And at that point, you know, I think that's what she needed internally and spiritually, because she hadn't had that. And so basically she became very much involved with the Catholic Church, but moved away from music altogether. And in this point, we're talking now, we're in the late 50s, early 60s. This is not in the film, but it certainly is in a book, and you can read about this. But very interestingly, she was in Harlem, and she basically became a business owner. She started owning these thrift stores. So she would buy secondhand clothing, and she basically took a break from music. And to fundraise for her thrift stores, she would, you know, have these like fundraising music parties where her old musician friends would come and play, you know, but she would have fashion, and she would have fashion shows and everything. So she never moved away from music completely, but she wasn't really recording at all, but very much heavily going into the Catholic Church and getting guidance and mentorship and spiritual fulfillment there, and actually converted. She converted to Catholicism in the late 50s, until one of the priests that was her confessor said, you know, Mary, you're an artist and you need to get back to your music. You know, you need to, you can't basically spend your life proselytizing about Catholicism. That's my job. You're an artist. You bring people to music. Why don't you write a jazz mass? And so, thank goodness, she was with a Catholic church that appreciated the arts and was kind of forward thinking in its, for them, as a Catholic, you don't think of a Catholic church as, basically asking a musician to write a jazz mass, and of course, jazz having a history of being the devil's music and everything. It really was a very interesting church. I think it's St. Xavier's Church in New York City that she belonged to.
If I could just jump in, it was a Jesuit priest who also ended up becoming Mary Lou's manager.
Right. That's Father Peter O'Brien, and I'll definitely get to him. But her confessor was Father Anthony Woods, and he was the one that said, Mary Lou, write a jazz mass. And that's what she did. She started to compose spiritual music for the Catholic Church, for actual liturgy. So this is, again, something that was very unique and groundbreaking, because it wasn't like a jazz performance in a church. This is actually like the mass, music for an actual ritual within the Catholic Church. So this is music for the church that, she was writing for. And she wrote like three masses and other spiritual music for the church. And it was at that point where Father Peter O'Brien, who eventually became her manager, sought her out, and basically the two of them formed a very close relationship to the end of her life. And he became her champion. He was someone that he said, because at this point she really kind of moved. She was much more of a recluse, and people who knew of her, obviously jazz musicians always knew of her, but she wasn't out there in the way that she had been out there previously. And Father O'Brien, to his great credit, and he passed a few years back, was very instrumental in getting her back out onto the jazz scene and also getting, her religious music played. And so from the 60s to her death, she kind of came back. She would play at the Cookery in New York City, which was a very well-known jazz spot in Greenwich Village. She got out there traveling around the country, around the world, actually, back to the jazz festivals. And then at the very end, I'd say the last 10 years of her life, she and Father O'Brien were artist in residence at Duke University. So she became an educator as well.
Okay.
And that's where she passed.
Mm-hmm. And they ended up with her archives, I believe. Is that correct?
They have some of her archives at Duke University, but the majority of her archives are at the Institute of Jazz Studies in Newark, New Jersey. If you want to learn anything about Mary Lou and really, delve into her life, you have to take a visit to the Institute of Jazz Studies in Newark. And I can't tell you, that was my second home in making this film. And the staff is great, because everything, her manuscripts, her music, the photographs, her she also painted, her visual art, just mementos, everything, was really kept together. And when she passed, Father O'Brien passed that collection on to the Institute of Jazz Studies in Newark.
Gotcha. It may surprise people that the Institute of Jazz Studies, which is in Newark, and I think it's part of Rutgers, I could be wrong, but it is, I think, the biggest collection of jazz scholarship material on earth. So there's many, many reasons to pay a visit there. This brings us kind of full circle, because the reason I now understand something that I didn't understand all these years. The reason that I heard Mary Lou Williams is she was invited to come and perform at my school, which was a Jesuit high school in Manhattan. And it was kind of out of the blue. It's like, okay, everybody, we're going to the we're going to the auditorium, and we're going to listen to this lady play music, you know. And we're like, okay, <You know? laughs> but you know, it always stuck with me. I always remember that a lady named Mary Lou Williams came to school one day and played for us. Now I realize where that this was would have been 75, 76. So now I have the sense of where that was in her life and career, and it makes sense since her manager was a Jesuit priest that he could get her a gig
right
at the high school. I wish they had told us what we were listening to, you know. It was just they just sort of marched us in there, and you know, I don't know if it would have made a difference, but it would have made some difference. It would have made some difference. Well, you know, we've gotten a really good idea, a beginning idea, and I say that seriously. Beginning, because this is clearly a musician that deserves a lot more attention, you know, scholarship, a lot more listening, and a lot more appreciation. And I've learned a lot on this call. I didn't really understand the full scope of her career. I was aware of her bebop connections, but I just didn't know until I encountered your movie that she was also one of the kind of top arranger composers for the swing era. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. I mean, and I think she stated this quote too late in her life, that she's one of the last living people that was part of both of those eras. I mean, a lot of musicians, as we were talked about in the call, they thrived during the swing era, and then, you know, they kind of weren't so famous afterwards. And then you had another generation that with bebop that you know, we're on the ascendancy after, but very rare to have anybody make that jump, especially at a high level. She was high level on both sides of the chasm, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So tell us again, Carol, if you would, the name of the movie and how people can go out and get a copy and find it.
Okay. So again, the name of the movie is Mary Lou Williams, The Lady Who Swings the Band. And again, it is for sale for the educational market, DVDs, and streaming. If you have a subscription to Canopy.com, that's K-A-N-O-P-Y, Canopy.com, you can look at the film there. And so basically that's where it is available online. I think with Canopy, certain public libraries have memberships to it. Certain schools and institutions have memberships to it. So if you have an affiliation to Canopy.com, you can find the film on there and screen it online. And if you don't have an affiliation to Canopy, then ask your public library or ask your school institution to become a subscriber to Canopy, because they have thousands of incredible films available online for their subscribers. It's not just documentaries, but feature films and, you know, just an incredible collection. So that would be the way to find Mary Lou Williams, The Lady Who Swings the Band, online. Yeah.
Great. Canopy. So if you're a student, you know, tell your teachers that you've got to get this film and it's got to be shown in school, or the school needs to sign up for Canopy. If you're a jazz educator, I don't even need to tell you what to do. I mean, this is just such an obvious thing, especially with all the young women that are interested in jazz these days. I think Mary Lou could be a real inspiration, you know, to see that, you know, women are not a side issue in the history of jazz. They're really right at the center of it. And Mary Lou is probably the most prominent of women in jazz history, but she's by no means the only woman who had a big contribution to jazz that did not really get a fair shake in terms of the writing of the history and the appreciation of her contribution. So Mary Lou Williams, you know, you can find her on YouTube, you can find her on Spotify, you can download some of her music from iTunes, I imagine. Mm-hmm. If anybody's out there and wants to do the interesting task of finding famous Mary Lou Williams arrangements by, you know, for Benny Goodman and for Count Basie and put those together, if you do that, I will send an email to the entire Jazz on the Tube list and let them know where that is, because that I think would be a very important project. Well, great. Mary Lou Williams Project. www.jazzonthetube.com. Very interesting website, by the way. You'll learn a lot just from there.
Thank you. And then also you can, you know, we have our Facebook page and Twitter. So you log on to the website. If you have any questions, you can contact me through the website. You can like, you know, the Facebook page and follow the Twitter feed and all that. So
great. And I imagine if, you know, there are a lot of jazz societies around the country, and if we have any listeners who are a member of a local jazz club or jazz society, I bet Carol would not mind making an arrangement to screen the film for your group. And again, this is just really, really important history. And, you know, if we want to do the music justice, we have to make sure we don't neglect somebody who deserves greater recognition. And I think Mary Lou Williams is, I think, to me, like I said at the beginning of the call, top of the list. To me, that would be the big accomplishment if somehow everybody who loved jazz just knew, you know, oh yeah, Mary Lou Williams, really important, did all those amazing arrangements for Count Basie and Benny Goodman, and was a mentor to Bud Powell, Thelonious Monk, and Dizzy Gillespie, and others. So Carol Bash, thank you so much. This is great. Thank you so much for making this film and spending the time in enlightening us and educating us about this really important musician.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Anytime. And thank you for having me, Ken. I enjoyed it.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.